Thank you.
We're holding on page 16 in Bava Kamma, beginning Meruba Perikshvi, middle of Ois Chof. Page 16 in Bava Kamma. Most of the Perek Meruba deals with, we know the Torah tells us that b'chlal, that in general, if a person steals something, then he has to pay double, and if he steals an ox or a sheep and shechts it or sell it, then if it's a sheep, he has to pay four times as much, and if an ox, he has to pay five times as much. So most of the Perek deals with the ins and outs of those dinim. Now, one basic concept that we have when it comes to the halachos involving a ganav and paying back and so forth is when does he have to give back the actual item versus when does he just have to return the value of it? There are certain cases, which the Gemara discusses in detail in this perek and in some other places, about when the ganav is koine, that he legally acquires the thing that he stole, and therefore now he's not obligated to return the thing itself, only its value. So one of the criteria is called shinui, if there's an irrevocable change to it. So the Gemara deals with that matter in terms of if a person steals an animal, at what point is there considered to be a change in it? If he stole a baby animal and it matured, for example. So the Gemara comments in that connection, why shouldn't we consider it that there's shinui hashem in that case? Never mind the fact that the animal is larger, and you could argue that's an irrevocable change. Don't you just have the fact that it changed the name before? Let's say, for example, he stole a calf. It's called egel in Hebrew. Now the animal grew up before he was caught, and now it's a full grown shur. So shouldn't we say the name change itself is enough to make that now he was koine it, and now he shouldn't have to return the actual animal itself, just its value? So the Gemara says, Omar Rava, shur ben yoyme kori shur. No, as a matter of fact, even a newborn ox can already be called a shur, even though there is a more specific name for it. It's called an eagle, but it can generically be called shur, and therefore we can't say the name has truly changed. Similarly, ayo ben yoyme kori ayo, and similarly a ram, even though a ram usually means an adult male sheep, but nevertheless, in a broader sense, it can be called an ayo even when it's born. And we can see that from Sukkim. So therefore, in other words, so in short, even if he stole a baby sheep or a baby or a baby cow, nevertheless, you can't say that when it matured, it has a different name now, because the fact is the name applied to it could apply to it all along. Shur ben yomri kori shur. Where do we see that a newborn ox is already called a shur? Dichtim, as the passage says, shur echesev ayez ki yivolid. The Torah describes when a shur or lamb or goat is born, then you have to wait until it's 8 days old before you can bring it as a korban. So therefore we see that even the newborn animal is already called a shur. Ayo ben yomri kori ayo. Where do we see that a ram, that a male sheep, can be called an ayo even when it's born? Dichtiv, we have when Yaakov is telling off Lavan, how could you do that? I worked for you for 20 years, and then now I'm finally leaving, and you're chasing after me and demanding why I stole things from you, and so on and so forth. And Yaakov gives Lavan a whole speech explaining what a scrupulously honest worker he was. So he says, "V'eilet son chaloya cholti." He says, "I never ate the rams of your sheep." Now, if Elim meant only full-grown animals, what would that mean? Elim hu delei achal, he never ate the rams, the grown-up sheep. Kvasim achal, would he be implying by that he ate the baby ones? That would also be Zela. And his whole point is, he's explaining how he didn't do even a trace of Gezel. Therefore, we see from that the word ayo can apply even to a newborn animal. So he's saying, I didn't eat any animals of yours that I wasn't supposed to, neither the babies nor the adults. What do we learn from this? Habona points out, you learn from this. An animal is born in a certain state, and it's never going to get, and it'll get physically larger and more mature, but it's never going to develop to a higher quality, as opposed to a person is born as a baby, and they're expected to develop and become greater in midas and in mice and toism and so on and so forth. And in that sense, therefore, sometimes you have a person is going to complain about, yeah, but I was born in a bad mazel, or I was born with this and this tendency. Well, a person has to realize that he has to work to overcome those. He can't be a shur or an ayo always remaining the same as when he was born. He has to grow beyond that. Further on, the Gemara talks about, so again, you have this business where if a person stole an ox or a sheep and then shechted it or sold it, so without the shechting or selling, he would pay kafel, he'd pay double, and when he shechts it or sells it, he pays four or five times as much. Further on, we'll learn a piece about why those numbers. As far as the double payment, actually, the Rambam gave one for one, the Rambam gives a logical reason behind it. The Ganav tried to deprive the other person of X amount. So let's say, for example, he stole an animal which is worth $100. So he was trying to deprive the other guy of $100. So what do? We make him not only return that $100, we make him pay another $100. That way, he's losing what he tried to make the other guy lose. That's the idea behind paying kafel. But then we're saying that if he shechted or sold, then he pays four or five, and later on we'll learn a piece that discusses why those numbers. So Tanya, Omer Rabbi Akiva, name Ma Omer Torah Tovo Chamacha Mishalom Tashlum Abav Chamisha. Why does the Torah say that if he shechted or sold the animal, that now he has to pay four or five times as much? The reason is because he rooted himself in Aveda. So Rashi explains, he made himself stronger in the chet, because now, by shechting or selling it, now he made it, that basically that's irrevocable, that now he was koneh, now this is definitely shinui maisa, this is an irrevocable change to the animal, and therefore now it's not returning, or the shinui reshus, which the Gemara discusses as well, and therefore that now it's not returning to the original owner. So nishtarish b'chet, it can mean that So the Gemara discusses in more detail. It can have a couple of different meanings. It can mean what Rashi is saying over here, that it means that now he made the chet even worse, namely that until now he had stolen it, but conceivably, if the owner hadn't had yish yet, then he would have to return the original animal. Now, as a result of having shechted or sold it, now there's no obligation to return the actual animal itself. And if he shechted it, of course, he can't return the live animal anymore. And therefore, in that case, he compounded what he did by making it that now it's irrevocably his, and he's only returning the value to the owner. Another way of looking at it, the Gemara discusses, is it just means like he compounded the Aveda. He not only did one Aveda, which is serious enough to steal, but now he went even further into it by shechting or selling it. So like he compounded what he did.
What's 4 to 5?
The 4 or 5 payments for an ox or a sheep, yeah.
Page 16.
Yeah. The Gemara has a whole sugya on the subject about it gets into the details exactly under what circumstances is the gan of kona the object, and therefore the Gemara explains you have a couple of different ways of understanding what Rabbi Akiva is saying. And the Gemara says one explanation, because he repeated the Aveda. Because he not only stole, but now he compounded it and did, and even repeated, and went even more by completely irrevocably taking it away from the other person by shechting it or selling it. So therefore, that's why the Torah is more stringent on him. There's an interesting explanation that first of all, we're going to learn in the Gemara later on that it applies specifically to a sheep and an ox, and the Gemara is going to discuss why 4 and 5. There's an interesting point, actually. Ion Yaakov makes a point over here we're going to talk later on why the Torah makes different amounts for an ox or for a sheep, but why only those two kinds of animals anyway? Why don't we say that the 4 or 5 should apply equally well? Somebody stole somebody else's donkey, somebody stole somebody else's bird or something. Why dafka by an ox and a sheep? So the fact is, the Gemara learns from Sukkim that it applies only to them, but what's the reasoning behind it? Ion Yaakov points out, because those are animals that could have been brought as korbanos. You could ask, then, what about Torum of Bnei Yonah? Those are birds that can be brought as korbanos as well. Still, again, the Gemara does learn from Sukkim that it applies only to oxen and sheep. Reb Shamshon or Fall Hirsch, actually, in his Pirush on Chumash, gives a very interesting explanation. He says, Bechlal, first of all, he gives a reason for why, again, the reason why you have the Tashlumi Kefal in the first place. He says, Bechlal, that there should be, that people are able to assume that those things are going to be safe and they're not going to be just taken and stolen willy-nilly. It means a person has to be able to depend on the society around them, to be a decent, to be made up of decent moral people who are going to respect other people's property. In a certain sense, therefore, everybody is a shomer on each other's property. So now if a person instead violates that trust and goes and steals from somebody else, so now he's abused his position as a shomer. So for that reason, that's why the Torah is being stringent on him and making him pay double. Now, on top of that, after Hirsch goes on to say, oxen and sheep, among all the animals that a person might have, he's more likely to leave them grazing out in the open. We're going to learn probably tomorrow, Beis Hashem, we'll talk about there are certain dinim. You can't always just let your animals graze willy-nilly. They'll damage other people's fields. But the fact is, you do have places in public property, like in forests, where you can leave your animals grazing, and normally you're going to do that. So there, even more, why would a person do that and not be afraid that somebody's going to walk off with his sheep or his ox? Again, because he can trust that he's living in a society where people are not going to do that, where people are going to be respecting each other's property. So therefore, now if a person doesn't do that and does go and steal the sheep or the ox, and on top of that, as the Gemara is saying over here, he compounds it by making that now that original sheep or ox is never going to return to the original owner, then we're going to penalize him even more, because he's even more abusing the trust of the other guy who trusted that he should be able to leave this animal grazing out in the open and that nobody would take it. So therefore, that's why we penalize him more. Further on, the Gemara talks about it's like this. The Gemara discusses a point. Suppose that Reuven owns an animal and Shimon stole it from him. Now, let's say while it's in Shimon's possession, Reuven wants to be makdish the animal as a korban. Can he do that? And the Gemara brings that no, because it's not in Reuven's possession right now. He doesn't know if he's going to even get it back from Shimon. He may not even know who Shimon is, after all. He knows that the animal was stolen. He doesn't know where it is that he should be able to get it back. So he can't be makdish it because Einad Birushose, it's not in his possession. Meanwhile, Shimon can't be makdish it either because it's not his. Anyway, so that leads the Gemara into the following discussion, where the Gemara says seems to be a contradiction to that, where we seem to have an example where there's something not in the person's possession, and still he's able to do monetary things with it in terms of hekdesh. So the Gemara says Tanan, we learn in a Mishnah in Masechta Ma'aseh. During Shemitah year, during the Shemitah year, all of the fields and everything are hefker. Anybody can go into anybody else's field and pick whatever fruit and produce they want. The problem is that you're going to have fruit which is also for one reason or another. What if the fruit is orla, for example? What do you do in order to alert the public that this is Orla, that they should know not to take from it? And maybe to a certain extent during the rest of the years as well. Do you want to, here's what we're going to be discussing over here. Do you maybe want to put up some kind of warning thing in general on a field with Orla trees in it to warn passersby in case you think of taking this fruit, which would be stealing, be aware that it's Orla. So the Mishnah describes what you do in this connection. So Tanan, Kerem Revai, a vineyard which is a Revai, which is the fourth year. Now we know the Torah tells us the first 3 years of a fruit tree, the fruit is Orla, and it's also to eat, and it's also Bahana. And then the fourth year is called the Revai, Vashana Revias. In the fourth year, then all the fruit is holy. It has basically the same dinim as Ma'aseh Sheni. You either have to take it to your Shalayim and eat it there when you're Tahor, or you exchange it for money, and you take the money to your Shalayim and buy food, etc. The Gemara mentions in Brachas and Machlokas whether the concept of Revai applies only to grapevines or whether it applies to fruits in general. The halacha is it applies to fruits in general, but this Mishnah is phrasing it in terms of grapevines, which everybody agrees that it's subject to. Anyway, Kerem Revai, Hoyim Mitzainin Oisek Zuzes Adama. They would mark it with clods of dirt around the edges of the field where there's these vines that are growing grapes that are in the fourth year of the vine. They would put clods of dirt all around it. Etz Yosef brings from the Aruch, it doesn't just mean any old dirt. Specifically, they would use a reddish dirt, but they would use clumps of dirt over there to mark it. And the Gemara interjects why. The Gemara interjects into the Mishnah why. Simana. The simon is to remember ki adama. That way you'll remember that this field is in a certain sense, like earth. Ma adama ika namina. Earth, you have hana from it. You're going to go a regular earth of this kind. You can plow it and plant it and you'll grow a crop over there. Af hainami, the same way, netzer revai, kerem revai, is not completely off limits. Ki nifrika, when you redeem it, shori les hanuyimina, then you're allowed to have hana from it. So it's not like Orla, which is completely off limits. It's temporarily restricted until you either take it to your shalayim or redeem it for money, as the case may be. So using Earth.
Orla. Why didn't they mark it from the time that it was...
That's the next thing the mission is going to say. That during Orla, they use a different marking.
Okay.
Yeah. So in that fourth year, then you mark it with these clods of dirt, and anybody who passes by and sees the borders of the field marked with that, that will put them in mind of, oh, dirt. That reminds us that this field, that this the produce of this field is like dirt in the sense it's netzeravai. So we can't just eat it willy nilly, but we could let's say again we're talking about doing shemitah. We can't just take from it willy nilly, but we should know if we redeem it for money, then we'll be able to eat. Then we'll be able to take it and eat it. Next, the Mishnah continues. Vishal Urla, as far as if the field has trees in it that are Urla, then b'chausis. Then they would mark it with chausis. Rashi says that chausis is specifically they would take bricks or tiles and grind them up into a powder or a paste. So basically, the tiles or bricks were made out of baked clay. So now you would take them and grind them up into little clay fragments, and you would use those to mark a field that contains Urla. Again, why is that? The Gemara explains, Simona Kachausis. The point is that simon is that this field is in a certain sense like that broken up earthenware. Ma chausis she'en hanah mina. If you try to plant in chausis, you're not going to get hanah from it. You're not going to grow anything there because it doesn't have the nutrients that a plant needs. Tosfos elsewhere actually points out, you could, it's not like you couldn't plant seeds in it. It's not like they would never germinate and start growing in chausis, but you wouldn't even, it would grow so little because it has so little nutrients in it that you wouldn't even get back a crop equal to the amount you planted. Let's say you took a saw of wheat grains, for example, and planted them in a place that was covered with chausis. When you come to harvest it, you wouldn't even get a saw of wheat. So in that sense, you don't have hanah from it. So that helps you remember. The same way Orla, you're not allowed to have hanah from. So chausis is a good appropriate simon for a field that contains Orla. Next, the shel kvaros. What about if the field contains graves and koyanim after and koyanim and other people who have to remain tahor need to know to stay away from there? The sid, then you mark those with lime. You would mark those with lime. The Gemara in Moed Cotton has a whole sugya on the subject of how exactly you would mark. You want to make sure that the whole area that's tameh is marked so nobody accidentally overshadows it. You don't want the marking to be too far away from it because you don't want to ruin, you don't want to keep more of Eretz Yisrael off limits than necessary. It's a whole detail over there. Anyway, so they would mark it with lime, and the Gemara says, why? Simona d'chiver ka'atzamos. The simon is because lime is white, so that puts you in mind of bones. So when you see a marking of white like that, then that'll remind you that there are bones, that there are human remains around here. And again, a Koyan or anybody else who has to stay Tahor will know to stay away from there. And the Mishnah continues, Umimacha v'shoifich. What he would do is with the lime, he would dissolve it in water and then pour it in the area, in or around the area, which is Tomei. And the Gemara says, why? Kehecha d'nechaver tfei. So that it will be as white as possible. Plain lime is not going to be pure white. When you mix it with water and pour it, then it's a bright white color and therefore it'll be very noticeable. Amr of Shimon Gamliel. So Rav Shimon Gamliel continues in this vein, continues in this vein. Now, when does all this apply that you need to do these markings is when it's doing Shemitah year. So it's doing Shemitah. Everybody is perfectly entitled to be taking from the fields. So therefore, in order to not be machshel, a fellow yid, then you have to make these markings with clods of dirt or ground up bricks or whatever. But Rav Shimon Gamliel says, if it's during the other years of the Shemitah year, what does anybody have any business coming into your field and taking and then picking fruit anyway? They're a gazlan. So in that case, Rav Shimon Gamliel says, Haliteu the Rosh of Yomus, then feed the Rosh and let him die. In other words, don't mark anything. If a guy is going to come in there and take fruit illegally, because don't you hate, you know what, if it's going to be Orla, let him be Chayiv Misa, let him be Chayiv Misa or Malkus for it, and the same thing with the other ones. It's not our concern to make sure in that case to keep him away from doing an Aveda, because already he's doing an Aveda by stealing, says Rav Shimon Gamliel. The Chavis Yor actually wonders about this in one of his Trubas. I mean, how you talk about what happened to Koisar and Zelazeh. So, in fact, one answer that's given, Taka, is we're not talking about Sam, a person who maybe has a one-off thing. Right? Seal, we're talking about when the people who are going to be taking it are habitual criminals like that. So then at that point, you know what, there's a point where you're not responsible to make sure they're going to do the Aveira anyhow. They're going to steal anyhow. They're not going to be put off by the fact, let's say, that it's Orla or Netzer Avai or what have you. Then you might as well just leave well enough alone. And if they get in trouble for it, with the Eibishter, that's their problem, basically. On the other hand, continues the Mishnah, now this is the part because of which the Gemara brings this Mishnah, Vatsnuim, people who are tsniistic, people who want to be extra careful in mitzvahs, they would, at least as far as the case of Kerem Rivai, what they would do is they would set aside some money in advance for Omim, and they would say, anything that's picked from this vineyard, Mechulal Alamois Halalu, is deconsecrated, the kedusha of it is taken from the fruit and put onto these coins, and that way they're saving a fell at least, so they can't do anything with Orla, they can't prevent it, if it's Orla, there's nothing you can do with that, but at least as far as the Kerem Revai case, the Tznurim would at least make sure that even during other years when maybe people shouldn't be taking this fruit in the first place, they would set aside money to be mechalal any fruit that somebody else might pick illegally. The point is, the Gemara brings this in, and on the face of it, once the fruit's been picked, it's out of their rishus, so how are they able to be mechalal it? So don't you see that they are able to, and wouldn't that apply to the case that we talked about before, where, for example, an animal was stolen for a person, and now he wants to be makdish it? So the Gemara goes on with the sugya over here. But we see that that's why we're bringing this in over here, because of this idea. On the one hand, a person might think to say, "I'll Rosh of a Yomus. Why do I care about this Rosh? Let him just stuff himself and die." But the Tznuim don't want to do that. They want to go the extra mile to make sure that there shouldn't be any possibility that because of them, a fellow Yid doesn't have air.
But on Shvit, it's all Hefker. They can take it.
So during Shmita,
need this
that's the point.
Feed or any of these other things.
Yeah, so that's the point. So during Shmita, when anybody can come into anybody else's field, you need these markings so that a person is going around collecting Shmita fruit for his family.
It's a mitzvah.
But nevertheless, you still have the dinim of Orla and of Netzer Avai and of Kvaris still apply. So you have to mark the fields appropriately.
Oh, okay.
Reb Shimon Gamliel is saying during the other 6 years, it's true, you don't have to mark them because Ali Taylor Rosh of Yamos. But we're saying that Tznurim would not use that loophole. They can't do anything, there's nothing they can do about Orla and about Kvaris. They're going to mark them if somebody is going to disobey them, if somebody is going to disobey and take, there's not a lot that they can do to avoid it, but at least as far as Kerem Revai, they have an alternative, they can be Mechalalit, and therefore they would do that.
Okay.
Fine. A few blocks later, the Gemara is dealing with the dinim of Edim Zomimin as it applies to these cases of stealing and Tovah HaMachar and all that, and the Gemara gets into a whole discussion about involving a matter of Tosh Kedei Dibur. When do we say that a person says something and he has Tosh Kedei Dibur to retract it, which the Gemara will explain soon what the time of Tosh Kedei Dibur is. So the Gemara mentions in this connection an opinion of Rabbi Yossi that during Tosh Kedei Dibur, a person has the ability to retract things that he said. There are certain exceptions where a person does not. The Gemara mentions in a couple of places, for example, Kiddushin, a person is Makadish, a woman, Arayat Makudashasli, he doesn't have Tosh Kedei Dibur to retract it. She's already Makudish to him. A couple of other examples, Birkas Hashem is another one. There's a couple of examples where a person thinks very carefully before he's going to do something, and therefore he doesn't have Tosh Kedei Dibur. Tosfos and the Ran discuss in various places what the rationale is behind this concept of being able to retract Tosh Kedei Dibur. One explanation is it's just Gzeiros HaKosev, that's how it is. Another way of looking at it is a Takana Derabanan, because so the Tosfos discusses elsewhere. Suppose, for example, let's say a person is in the middle of a business deal. We're going to explain soon that Tosh Kedei Dibur is the amount of time that it takes to say to greet his Rebbe, where if his Rebbe is passing by, to say to him Shalom Alecha Rebbe or Shalom Alecha Rebbe Umuri. Now, if, let's say, he's in the middle of doing a business deal, and he says something, and just then his Rebbe passes by, if we don't allow him the leeway to be able to say Shalom Alecha Rebbe, then he's going to have to ignore his Rebbe, which would be disrespectful, so therefore we give him that amount of time to say Shalom Alecha Rebbe and quickly get back to his deal and say, you know what, I just realized it's not a good idea or something. So Tosfos learns it's on that basis, and the Ran says there's a different basis for it. Anyway, so the question is, v'savar Rabbi Yossi Tosh Kedei Dibur k'dibur dami? Does Rabbi Yossi in fact hold that Tosh Kedei Dibur is still considered like saying the same thing, and therefore that he's able to retract what he said during that time, and it's still considered all the same thing? V'hatnan, we learn in a Mishnah, suppose a person says, we know the Torah says a person is not allowed to make a tmura. A person has an animal for a korban, he's not allowed to say, I want to exchange it for this other animal. If he does, then he gets malchus, and v'hoyohu tmurasi yakodesh, both of the animals now have kedusha. So a Mishnah describes, hareza tmuras oila tmuras shlomim. What if a person says, a person has, let's say he has one animal which is an oila, and he has another one which is a shlomim, then he takes a third animal and says, I want this to be a tmura for the oila, a tmura for the shlomim. What happens? So hareza tmuras oila divrei Reb Meir. Reb Meir says it becomes a tmura of an oila. Once Reb Meir holds a concept the Gemara mentions elsewhere called tfois loshen rishon. Once he said it's a tmura of an oila, then that's it. It becomes a tmura of an oila. And now you can't change the kedusha of it to make it something else. So the result is that this third animal will be brought as an oila according to Reb Meir. Reb Yossi says it depends. Im lekach niskaven mitchila, if he actually meant to say to begin with tmuras oila and tmuras shlomim, then hoyu v'if shalikris beis shemis kachad. The fact is, he can't say tmuras oila and tmuras shlomim at once. Only the Eibishter can say shomer v'zalcha v'jibarachad, but a human being can't. Dvarav kayomin, then what he said is valid. So the result is, says Reb Yossi, then it would mean it becomes a tmura of an oila and a shlomim. And since you can't, it has to be brought either as an oil or a shlomim, the result would be this animal has to be, this third animal has to be left to graze until it's pasture, until it develops a mum, and then you sell it and use half the money to buy an oil and half the money to buy a shlomim. So that's if he meant to do that to begin with. The im omat tmuras oil, the nimlach, the omat tmuras shlomim, however, if he says it should be a tmura of an oila, and then he rethought himself and said tmuras shlomim, then Rabbi Yossi agrees. How do you say tmuras oila? Then it's considered a tmura of an oila, because then he said it's a tmura of an oila, and he doesn't have the ability. He gave it the kedusha of an oila, and he does not have the ability to change that and make that now shlomim.
You can't change it.
Well, that's right. The difference is kedushin. You can't change even the Torah kedidibur. Here we're saying that's the Gemara is going to discuss. That we're saying we were talking about Torah kedidibur. When we say
you can't change the Torah
kedidibur, on the face of it. So the Gemara says, wait, v'havinan ba. So now when we discuss this point in the relevant Gemaras, we ask the Gemara asks the question, nimlach pshita. Of course, if he changed his mind, then it's poshut. Of course, he can't undo the fact that he made it an oila. What's Rabbi Yossi's chiddush? V'amar apapa nimlach b'Torah kedidibur kamrin. Because once he made it an oila, we don't know yet. We didn't yet realize the point about Torah kedidibur. We're talking about, and we have a concept called amira legavoya kemesira lahedya. When you're making a business deal with another person, you have to have some kind of kinyan, mishicha or hagbah or what have you. All of the various kinds of kinyonim. When it comes to hektish, you don't need that. Amir l'gavoya, just saying verbally, this will be a korban, or this will be hektish, or what have you, is enough to make it that now it has that status. So therefore, if he says, tmuras oila, and then, you know what, I don't want it to be a tmuras oila, I'd rather it be a tmuras shlomim. Of course he can't do that. What's the chiddush?
So he can't change his deal?
Yeah, well, yeah. The Omer Rapapa, nimlach b'tel kiredibu kamrinan. So the Rapapa says, what Rav Yossi means by nimlach, he means b'toch kedei dibur. He means it's all within that time of toch kedei dibur, but nevertheless, if he's changing his mind, then so it still has to be, even if it's b'toch kedei dibur, it has to be that it was obviously meant to be one long statement rather than he's changing his mind in the middle. So the point is, we see that Rav Yossi does hold of the concept that toch kedei dibur, you could change your mind. Actually, Tosfos discusses, it was actually in Daf Yomi a few days ago in Zvachim, Tosfos discusses that basically what we're saying is the definition of nimlach means after Torah Kedei Dibur. That if he said it for Torah Kedei Dibur, then we allow him to add, he can't change it, but he can add to it, which is what we're talking about over here, because he wants to add to Tumoras Oila, he wants to add to Tumoras Shlomim, that he could do Torah Kedei Dibur. But if he wants to completely change it and say it should not be an Oila, it should only be a Shlomim, that wouldn't work, even according to Rav Yossi.
Who's being, whether desecrated or who's being injured here or damaged? I mean, is it because of his bark? There's no other person on the understanding.
Yeah, we're talking about Hashem. He said that this animal is going to be a tmuras oila. Now he wants to make it instead tmuras shlomim, and we're saying that he can't do that. But again, if the fact is he's going to get malchus, but yeah. Anyway, the point is, we see that Rabbi Yossi does hold of the concept that under certain circumstances, at least, you can change or modify what you said, b'toch kedei dibur. So the answer is Amri. So the answer is Tshrei Torah Kedei Dibur Havu. There are two different definitions of Torah Kedei Dibur in Halacha. One is the amount of time that a Talmud would greet his Rebbe. Now, he wouldn't just say Shalom Aleichem, like you say to a regular person. He would say Shalom Alecha Rebbe, or Shalom Alecha Rebbe or Mori. There's different Rishonim have different understandings, whether it would include the word or Mori or not. So that's a slightly longer thing. The other one is a shorter. What the Rebbe would say to the Talmud, he would just say Shalom Alecha. He doesn't say obviously Rebbe or Mori or any title like that. So therefore, Ki Lesle the Rabbi Yosi Kadesh Ilas Talmud the Rav. You know when Rabbi Yosi does not hold of Tosh Kedibur, being Kedibur, is when you have the longer Nusach that a Talmud has to say to his Rebbe, namely Shalom Alecha Rebbe Umori. The Nafish, which is longer. So Rabbi Yosi says that's too long for it still to be considered the same within that amount of time. But Kedesh She'ilas HaRav LaTalmud, Shalom Alecha, but when the Rav says the Talmud, he only says the two words Shalom Alecha, Islay, Rabbi Yosi would hold that then you have a concept of Tosh Kedibur, and it is possible for a person to modify what he said during that time. So it depends whether we're talking
even without adding.
So we're talking about, and let's say in this case he wants to add on top of Tmuras Oyla, he wants to add Tmuras Shlomim, and therefore the result is that it's actually considered half Oyla and half Shlomim with the consequences that we said before. So Tosfos points out in this connection, then now there's a Gemara in Brochas that says that if a person greets his Rebbe or answers his Rebbe with Shalom, Gurim L'Shchina Shistalik Mi'Yisrael, he causes the Shchina to depart from the Jewish people. So how is it we're saying over here that the Talmud should answer that
Shalom? Maybe.
So that's Tosfos' answers, is that he says Shalom to his Rebbe like he would to his Chaver. He just says Shalom Alecha without adding Rebbe or without adding Rebbe or Murdi. But if he adds Rebbe or Murdi, then the Gemara is saying over here that is the proper thing to do. Now, Tosfos also goes on to mention, if it's an Eved, that's different. An Eved has no business greeting his master at all, even with Shalom Alecha Rebbe or any respectful title like that, because he should have more of a bittul to his master. But a Talmud, it can say to his Rebbe, he just has to say it with the proper Nusach, he has to say Shalom Alecha Rebbe or Shalom Alecha Rebbe or Murdi. Ben Yehoyada points out in this connection a remez. You know, we have a couple of psukim that we say in davening and in Omer Abelazar, Omer Abchanina that mention the word Rav and Shalom together. First of all, you have the word Shalom Rav La'ayve Sarasachav in Lomim Michshol. So he says that's hinted at in what we're saying over here. Shalom Rav, when a person gives a Shalom to his Rebbe in the proper way by saying Shalom Alecha Rebbe, then the in Lomim Michshol there'll be no stumbling. As opposed to not, if he just says Shalom, then as Tosfos says that has very serious consequences. The other one is we say v'chol b'nayich l'mudei Hashem v'rav shloim b'noich. The point is that that pasuk is primarily talking about la'osid lavoi, when all of us will be l'mudei Hashem, all of us will be well versed in Torah and not really have to learn from each other anymore. Nevertheless, even then, a person is still going to say v'rav shloim b'noich. Nevertheless, it'll still be right that a Talmud should be addressing his Rebbe by telling him shalom alecha Rebbe rather than just plain shalom. So the Gemara goes on a little bit later. The Gemara discusses the point like this. This whole thing that we're talking about in this perek about that the person that the ganav has to pay double, or that he has to pay four or five times as much, these are examples of what are called in halacha knas. Knas literally means a fine. The basic rule is, we touched on it earlier in the Masechta, any time when the Torah is telling you to pay a certain fixed amount or a certain amount different than the amount of the damage, then it's called a knas. So here, the double or four or five times as much. You have examples. For example, the Torah says that a person's ox kills somebody else's eved. He pays a fixed amount of 30 sloyim, whether the eved was worth less or more. That would be another example of a knas. And you have a variety of different things in the Torah that are called dine knosis. Those can be judged only by based in of smuchim that have the ones that have smicha ish mipiish back to Moshe Rabbeinu in there. And one of the differences between them and regular dine mominus, the Gemara explains, is you have the concept of mod. If a person goes to Beis Din and voluntarily admits that he is guilty of this thing, then he's potter from the knas. So let's say in the case of the ganav, if they catch him and bring him to Beis Din, then he's going to pay the double or four or five times as much. But if he himself surrenders himself to Beis Din and says, yes, I stole from Pliny, we're not going to make him pay the double or any of the other things.
It's before the witnesses come.
So that's if he does before the witnesses coming.
So he
meets. So the Gemara actually has it. The Gemara actually presents a machlokas about moedim b'knas v'achakas bo edim. What happens if later on edim do come and testify? Does that put back the knas on him, or once he admitted, then he's potter and remains potter? But yeah. Okay, so in this connection, the Gemara brings the following story. Rav Gamliel one time blinded the eye of his servant Tovi. Now we know, we have Tovi comes up throughout in various places in Shas. Rav Gamliel says on him, kosher hoya, that he was a kosher person. So the Mishnah mentions in Brachas, when Tovi passed away, then Rav Gamliel was having people come to be Menachem Ovel him, and people asked why. You don't normally do that for an Eved. Usually somebody's Eved dies, you say to him, like you would say, when he loses an animal or something, Hamokim Mimalach Hashem should make good for your loss. So why are we here? For Tovi and Eved Kanani, are you accepting Tanchumen? And Rav Gamliel tells them that he's not like other Avodim kosher. Oh, yeah, he was a kosher person. A Mishnah in Sukkah, Rav Gamliel calls him Chacham, that he's a Taman Chacham, he's learned Torah. So now, Rav Gamliel accidentally blinded him. Whereas for Meach, Simcha Gdola, he was very happy, because now he has an opportunity to free Tovi and make him a full-fledged Yid. Up until now, he's an Eved Kanani, he's chayiv only in some mitzvahs, like you have in that story in the Mishnah in Sukkah over there, for example. Tovi is sleeping under a bed in the Sukkah, because that way because he knows that as an Eved, he's not chayiv in the mitzvah of Sukkah. But he still wanted to be there to hear the conversations of the Talmid Chachamim, who were there, so therefore he found himself a place under the bed. So now Rav Gamliel is very happy. Until now, I can't free him because there's a mitzvah saseh in the Torah, la'olam behem talboidu, when you have an Eved Kanani, you're supposed to keep him, and you're not just supposed to free him without a good reason. But after all, the Torah tells us if a master knocks out his Eved Kanani's eye or tooth or any one of 24 other main body parts, then he has to set him free. So therefore, now Rav Gamliel is happy. I have an opportunity. I'm now required, I'll be Torah, to set Tovi free, and now he can become a full-fledged Yid. Matzah the Rav Yeshua, so Rav Gamliel meets up with Rav Yeshua. And he tells him, good news, don't you know that my servant Tovi is going to be going free? So Rav Yeshua says, why? What happened? And Rav Gamliel tells him, because I blinded him. Rav Yeshua tells him, what you're saying doesn't count for anything, because there are no Edim that saw you knocking out his eye, and this is an example of Knas, and no Edim, then we don't have a case over here. So therefore, you still have the din that you're not allowed to that you still have the mitzvah saseh not to free him.
That sounds really odd.
There is an interesting.
The goy can't be an aid. Eventually, he knows about the goy. He can't be an aid.
Never mind that. He would be nagei b'davar. You would need two kosher aidim as usual. Yeah.
So you don't have to kosher aidim.
If you don't have any kosher aidim, then you don't have a knas. Yeah. The Rashba actually brings over here from a Yerushalmi an interesting point in that regard. So let's say, for example, a person stole. So now we're saying if there's no edim, then the Beis Din cannot be mechayiv in the knas. What about if he wants to be lotzis yidei shemayim? What if he wants to after all, he knows that he did something wrong, and he wants to fulfill his obligation towards the Eibishter? Then he could go and voluntarily pay the guy the extra knas.
He just returns it.
Right, but here, that wouldn't apply. Because there's a mitzvah saseh not to free an Eved Kanani unnecessarily, the Rav Gamliel is not required to, and therefore is not allowed to, even as a voluntary thing. So he can't say, well, so what? If there were no Edom, I'll still be Yotzi Yedei Shemayim. By freeing him, doesn't work.
You can hold out. You can't get hold out if you're Eved Kanani.
That's the point. He's Moedim B'Knas, and Moedim B'Knas is Potter. This relates to this week's parasha, by the way. You know, how come we call these people Avodim Knanim anyway? This Tovi was not necessarily actually from the ethnic group of the Knanim. We call them Avodim Knanim because of the story in this week's parasha where Noach curses Knan Eved Avodim Yilechov. So the Medrash says on it actually, you think of it, Chom and Knan had over the generations many worthy people that descended from them. Tovi, as in our example, Eliezer Eved Avraham is another one. Look how much Chom and Knan messed up for their generations for all time to come, that they made it that now their descendants are relegated to being Avodim and can't even be freed and can't become full-fledged Yidin without something like this, without their eye or tooth or whatever being knocked out, all because of what Knan did to Noach, and Chum going and blabbing about it to his brothers. So you see how much they messed up for their descendants for thousands of years to come. Canaan did it, or Chum? Well, Canaan did it, and Chum told about it. The point is that they were both involved. Noach doesn't curse Chum directly because Chum was blessed by after the Mabul, and now he doesn't have the ability to curse him, but he curses him with Canaan, as it actually mentions, because Canaan is Chum's fourth son, and they had prevented Noach from having a fourth son, etc., the whole business. But you see, the Medrash says how what they did reverberates down for thousands of years later and causes that all these good people, like Tovi and like Eliezer, who were descended from them, now are relegated to being, or stuck in a status of being a Avodim. There is actually an interesting explanation that why of all the possible punishments that Noach gives, why does he choose that they should be Avodim? One idea is because he sees in Chum and in Canaan's characteristic that left to their own devices, they're going to be horrible people. But if they become Avodim, to shame and to a lesser extent to Yefes, that'll help civilize them and that'll help make them taka to be the kind of people that they should be, like Tovi by being Rav Gamliel's slave. What that means now, and what that means nowadays, when B'nai Chum and B'nai Knan are not Avodim, then that's left as an exercise for the listener. The Gemara goes on. Now one point is, all this time we've been talking about a Ganav, but you also have a Gazlan. Now, a Ganav is the one who's chayev to pay the double or the four or five times. A Gazlan is not. So the Gemara discusses as follows. Amar Rav Elazar, Ra'uhu shehitmin b'choshen. If we see that the thief hid himself in the forest. So now you have animals that are going to be grazing in the forest. We'll learn tomorrow, that's the Shem, that's one of the places in general you can't just have your animals graze in Eretz Yisrael wherever you want, because they're going to damage other Jews' fields, but you can have them graze in forests where nobody has fields anyhow. So now, let's say, so you have a ganav that hides out in the forest to grab animals that are there. So now, suppose that he's hiding out in the forest. The tovach u'machar, now if he goes and shechts an animal or sells it from there, meshalem tashlumei dalad v'hei, then he would be required to pay the four or five-fold payment, depending whether it was an ox or a sheep. So the Gemara asks, am I holding moshach? So the question is why? He didn't do meshicha on the animal, because we're talking about, let's say, the animal was just standing there in one place, and then he grabbed it and immediately shechted it on the spot. It might not even be standing, it might conceivably be lying down or something. And he just shechted it or sold it on the spot. So he never made a kinyan in it.
The animals in the hefker.
What?
Don't these animals hefker?
No, they're not hefker. They belong to somebody.
Obviously.
The somebody left them in the forest to graze. Put it there in the forest to graze, which is one of the places. What? What do you mean, how is he supposed to know? You know that these animals... We're not talking about a person who... No, we're not talking about a person who lives in a city like New York and has no idea what his neighbors own. We're talking about he's living in a little shtetl. Everybody knows what animals everybody else has.
How does he make kinyan?
The way to make kinyan with an animal would either be hagbah, you could lift it, you could do meshicha, you pull it.
Why would he make kinyan? I mean, like, he's not buying it from
because him. If he makes kinyan, then we can say, now it becomes his, now he can be chayiv into shlomi dalad v'hei if he shechts it or sells it.
If he shechts it and sells it, he's not tied back.
Well, that's what we have to figure out. Am I holy moshach on the face of it, if he didn't do meshicha, so he wasn't even koine it, so therefore, so how can we make him liable for the four or five fold payment, which involves that he brought it into his rishus first.
A guy of this color is not going to make kinyan. He's just going to shut.
That's the question. The answer is Amar of Chista shehi kisha b'makel. The answer is we're talking about where he hit it with a stick and caused it to run, and therefore that's considered meshicha. And now he was actually koine. Now it's considered his in halacha. And now therefore, if he shechts it or sells it, then we can apply the four or five time payment. There is a different explanation that a number of the Rambam and some other Rishonim have a different explanation. And Hitmin Bachurshin means that if he hid the animal in the forest. So he took the animal If he took it, then there's no question. But rather, let's say, for example, the animal was standing right near some trees and he took the branches of the tree and wrapped them around the animal to conceal it from other people. So this way now he can do whatever he wants with it and nobody's going to notice. And the question is, if he didn't do Meshicha, and the answer is he did. Let's say he did Meshicha, not directly, but let's say by hitting it and causing it to run, and that's also considered meshicha to the extent where he makes a kinyan on it. So the question is Amri, but we have another question. V'kivin de ra'uhu, If people saw him, Gazlan, who shouldn't he be considered a Gazlan? Where he Ganvet, Rashi explains, if he stole in front of two people, it means that the other people who see him are not the owners of the thing, so therefore he's not afraid of them, because he thinks to himself, you know what, if it was the owner who saw me, yeah, I'd be afraid to steal from him, but if it's just other people watching, then big deal, I'm not concerned about that.
I like the owner sees it.
Well, if the owner is seeing it, then that might hold him back. He might be afraid that the owner is going to go and beat him up or whatever for trying to steal his thing. But if he sees other people, so you could have a ganav who goes and steals something stealthily, but he, even though he notices that two people are there, he's not so afraid to do it because he figures big deal, or it's none of their business. But here we're talking about that they're grazing in the forest. It's a place where everybody takes their animals to graze. To that extent, he's not going to know whose it is. He's not going to know. He's going to know that they're not Hefker. So let's say, okay, to modify what we said before, it's not that he's going to know that these animals specifically belong to Pliny, but at least he's going to know these are not Hefker animals. So therefore, he's apparently not afraid of anybody. He has no way of knowing whether the actual owner of the animal is present. So why are we calling him a Ganev rather than a Gazlan? And if he's a Gazlan, he shouldn't be Chayev for Tashlum Kefal or Tashlum Abav HaChamisha in the first place. The answer is Kivin to Kamitamri Minaihu Ganavu. The answer is, since he is hiding from them, he's hiding among the trees, or he's hiding the animal among the trees, therefore he's considered a Ganav rather than a Gazlan. And as a Ganav, therefore he's Chayev for the Kefal, etc. So the question is, Ve'ela Gazlan Hechidomi, well then what is the definition of Gazlan? We thought that it meant just that a Ganav is afraid whether the owner sees him, and a Gazlan is not. But now if we're saying that he's not afraid of who's going to see him, why don't we call him a Gazlan? What is the definition of a Gazlan then? The answer is, Amar Rabbah Bohu, Kegon Benayahu Ben Yehoyada. You can have an example from a pasuk describing Benayahu Ben Yehoyada, was one of David's top men in his army. We learned yesterday about the top tier soldiers in David's army that are described in the pasuk, and we have the whole story involving the lentils and the barley and all that. So one of those top people that it mentions over there was Benayahu ben Yehoyada, and by a few of these top people, it mentions specific exploits that they did in battle. So one of them, by him, it says that at one point he was fighting one on one with a huge mitzri. The pasuk says this mitzri was 5 amas tall. Keep in mind, a regular person is 3 or 4 amas tall. So this guy was a basketball player or taller. So he's a big, powerful guy. And the pasuk says, by Yigzel Asachanis Miyada Mitzri, Benayahu grabbed the spear. This guy was holding a spear and threatening Benayahu with it. And Benayahu grabbed the spear away from this guy by Yahugeu Bachanisa and killed him with his own spear. So therefore, that's the definition of Zela, is grabbing something out of somebody else's hands. Over here, he's not grabbing the animal out of somebody else's hands, therefore he's a guy. Oh, you're right. I didn't realize how late it had gotten. Fine. Okay, then I guess we'll continue tomorrow. But, yeah. Okay. I thought, for some reason, I thought we had 7, but I forgot. All right, let's wrap it up then quickly. Yom Yom Mashiach Ge'ula. Mashiach Ge'ula, first day of Rosh Chodesh Cheshvan, Mamed Tishrei. Mashiach's Malchus is going to be even greater than the Malchus of Moshe Rabbeinu, because Mashiach will be Murdach V'doy, and he can smell and judge people based on that. So he's going to have power that he can see everybody's shnimius based on just smelling. Now, a king has to judge based on Edim, whereas Mashiach was saying, will not even need Edim, he can use smell. Okay, halacha of continuing with the halacha of getting up in the morning.
Yeah. More than Joshua, I think.
Yeah. That's what he says. Yoram Munista Vagov Amoid will be greater than Avim, than Adam, greater than Moshe Rabbeinu. Yeah. Okay. Person gets up in the morning. The first thing he should say is Moda Ani, and that way he remembers Hashem who's standing over him, and he wakes up Bezrizus. How he should say Moda Ani, what posture, we'll talk about tomorrow, Bez Hashem.
That was a minute.